Hello?
Hello.
Oh, hi, David. How are you?
Good. How about you?
Oh, good, thanks. It's Shirley Leonard from Edmonton, Alberta.
From where?
Edmonton, Alberta.
Oh, okay.
Is this David?
This is David Kisland.
Oh, I think I'm supposed to, am I on the wrong call?
No, you're on the right call. We're just waiting for him to
Oh,
show
okay.
up. Yeah,
Okay,
because
you
he's
had
here
me
for a minute.
fooled there.
I was like, I don't know anybody in Edmonton.
Yes, I'm in snowy Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We had hopefully our last winter snowstorm yesterday.
How much did you get?
Not as much as they were predicting. I think we probably got about 6 centimeters altogether, but it came with a wild, wild wind and zero visibility and whiteout conditions. And it's just like, oh, please, let's just get in the spring. I'm done with winter 2021.
Yeah, I'm in Montana. I kind of feel
Yeah,
the same way.
where are you located?
Outside of Billings, Montana.
Oh, you've had winter too.
Yeah, but it's like spring today. It's
Yeah, us
wonderful.
too. Yeah. We're not warm, but we're above zero, thank goodness. And but yeah, and no snow. We're supposed to hit +13, which on Wednesday, which will be about that's about 50, I think, for us.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's
Yeah.
nice.
Well, it'll be just divine. It will be divine, yes. Oh, gosh. Yes.
Was outside without a coat earlier this afternoon. Actually,
Oh, that's great.
I went skiing in the morning, and by the time I came home, it was totally spring.
Oh, that's brave. Wow. Wow. I'm very envious, actually. Although I could probably go out without a coat, but I would end up probably getting a cold out of that. So anyway, yeah. So I'll wait for my 2 days until we get to, into the teens.
Yeah.
How many people are on the call?
Was wondering the same thing. I have not a clue.
Well, hey, everybody, and welcome. I hope you're all doing great. Thank you again for all the questions you've sent in. I wanted to address a couple of the questions at the beginning here. Notice that for those of you who sent in questions about change, it's a basic area of questions that we have as coaches, and I hope that some of our discussion last time, and especially the content that I worked those questions into a way of addressing was helpful. And I hope you, if you had a chance, looked at my blog, How Can We Help Someone Change Their Mind? There are a couple of questions. I need you to manage the background noise. I'd like to keep it open, an open mic for questions and discussions at the beginning and the end instead of going to lecture mode. There are a couple of questions I want to ask, but anybody want to check in, say hi, or add or ask anything that you want to clarify from last time or set up the beginning of what we may discuss in this seminar, if you've looked at the outline. Anyone?
Hi, David. It's Shirley Leonard from Edmonton, Alberta. Just
welcome. Hey.
Able to join you. Hi, I'm delighted to be here this time. So
great.
I'm
Welcome.
going to listen avidly. So thank you so much.
Okay. Well, don't hold back. Okay. Great. Thank you again for all of you who have sent in responses to the questions. Anyone else? I appreciate you managing the background noise because we have a large number of people. What I'd like to do is to add on some time, 10 or 15 minutes, to our fourth seminar after the top of the hour just to have a discussion. So jot down anything that we don't get to that you want to add or ask, and we'll have a discussion to look at anything we didn't cover during that time. So anything else from anyone? Well, I wanted to mention when you still open mic, one of the things that the questions that I saw focused on change and how do we facilitate that? How do we ask powerful questions? Something very basic, but here's a study that I think gives an answer from a different area, and that's always what I'm interested in. What's the simplest study that will illustrate a mind-brain or performance science principle? And if it's from a different field of study, which it will probably need to be from one of those areas, it can be even more meaningful. This is a study of college-level tutors. And the paper in an academic journal was titled, Why Do Only Some Events Cause Learning During Human Tutoring? That's the kind of thing that we ask in a way, although our objective is not learning or training. And the best learning, they found, occurred at the point that the student needed an increment from reaching an impasse, was ready to receive input at a time of impasse. The biggest gains were from engaging a particular challenge or struggle at the time it occurred, and not in functioning for the student. Tutors actually impaired learning when they provided answers and support too quickly, particularly when the student was not at an impasse. So this is something that I think can emphasize how a challenge can prompt deep learning. Think about how we learned as parents not to take over and keep tying our kids' shoes. It would have been easier for both our kids and us to keep doing that, but the child learned frustration, tolerance, and then learning. And they also saw reflected in us that we believed in them, and they internalized that belief. They looked into the mirror of the parent and developed that innate ability to learn and to persist and became a belief in themselves. So asking a question rather than giving information opens engagement to join collaboratively. And it keeps the point of reference in the client's story. And giving an answer or suggestions or even camouflaging a suggestion in a question, well, have you thought about, it keeps the point of reference in the client's story and developing that. Because it's easier to give advice, to answer a question, because it ends the discomfort for both coach and client when you do that. But this is a way to prompt learning. This is so fundamental, but it's so important in terms of developing a story with a client, because we're going to be talking in this seminar about developing a system to understand a story. This is a macro system to look at and understand the beliefs and assumptions that someone has as they manifest in the story. And we each have a conviction that we see things as they are, that our beliefs and responses are determined by objective perceptions. And we also believe, unless we've coached for a good while and been frustrated consistently, just given the right information, other rational and reasonable people would reach the same conclusions we have. But here's a perspective on that. Guess who said this? Have you ever noticed that anybody driving slower than you is an idiot, or anyone driving faster than you is a maniac? That was the sage and prophet George Carlin. So here's a short list of some anatomical realities in your brain and in the brain of every client. Facts, beliefs, identity, patterns such as attachment, emotional behavior. Repeat it long enough and it hardwires. But change can occur. I'm going to go to the lecture mode because, so you don't have to worry about the background noise, because there is a bit of background noise. I'll reserve some time at the end, so jot down any questions or things you want to add or ask. So whether it's storylines of money, wellness, career, relationship, or other specific things like bias, belief, blind spot, here's a system to use, the roadmap system. It's the acronym for the seven steps of how to understand, how to deconstruct a story, and a systematic way of constructing a new one. So it's a system of understanding and catalyzing stepwise change that integrates psychology and neuroscience with strategic coaching. And we're going to focus on the wellness story and look at each of these steps in terms of working with a client in the area of wellness. And remember, this is applicable, same principle, same process, same system for looking at any other storyline, money, relationship, life story, any other aspect. We'll just focus on this for the purpose of wellness. So now I want to give you a summation in the beginning of the roadmap system. We basically decide, if you think about it, three things: what we focus on, what it means, and what we do about it. Now, these three steps form the foundation of writing your life story, your wellness story. Each are decisions and shape your present and your future. Focus, meaning, action. So this is how we create a story. Whatever you think and feel and experience, you create each moment. You process and decide what you do and how you act on it. This is your story. Now, some of this may be so automatic because it's hardwired. We do it automatically. And that's the job description of the brain, that once you do something and repeat it enough, that it makes it automatic, makes it the default mode. So each of the seven steps, and I hope you have your outline for this, to look at the seven steps, because we're going to be looking at each of these, and we're going to talk about the first four steps in this seminar. This is what the acronym roadmap is about: to recognize authorship, to own your story, to assess the plot and storylines, decide what to change, map wellness strategies, author new experience, and then program new wellness experiences and identity. Each step is really simple, but it's not necessarily easy. The actual implementation can be difficult because it can require us to change the way we think about our lives, to break bad or outdated habits, to develop new ones, or remain disciplined over the long haul, or even the simplest, as we discussed last seminar. Whenever we take one step into a new or different experience, it registers automatically as discomfort, as the error mechanism in our brain, error detection mechanism, says, this is not what I expected. So it registers immediately as some kind of discomfort. Now, the first three steps are about awareness, a systematic way to ask questions of yourself or your client. So let's look at these in sequence here. Step one, recognize authorship of your wellness story. Now, remember this premise. Every moment we actively construct what we think, feel, and experience. Every day begins a fresh page. Insight, understanding, even coming to the end of the past and ending an old story are important, but they're not enough. You have to create a new or at least revised story. That's where you're going to see some people who have gotten frustrated with therapy, because they understand the old story. They've come to the end of the old story, but they don't necessarily have a new story to enter or inhabit, or a new pattern sequence in their brain of how to deal with what they're experiencing now and next. So how can we tell our life and wellness story to ourselves in order to know what aspects work and which need to change? The simplest question that was put to me, I was talking with publication of a book about money story with a very well-known editor, and he said, you know, Dave, I realize I don't know how to tell my money story to myself in order to know what to change. I said, well, that puts it very elegantly. And, of course, that's the reason you need to publish this book with me. So, all right, here are four principles in recognizing authorship. First principle, our experiences are always consistent with our assumptions. Our beliefs are what we consider our basic truths that determine our experiences and our results in life. Our beliefs write the software of our behavior. And you can't just suddenly, oh, I've got a new belief, because beliefs are part of an anatomical reality of the brain. You don't just introduce a new idea and it suddenly overwrites the old one. Here's an example. A baby elephant can be trained from birth to be confined to a small space. The trainer ties a rope around its leg and stakes the rope in the ground. The baby elephant will initially try to get away, try to break the rope, but the rope is strong relatively to the baby elephant, and it can't. So this baby elephant has to stay in the area determined by the length of rope. Now, fast forward, this elephant grows to a mammoth adult size. 6 to 8 tons, it could easily break the rope, but it doesn't, because earlier as a baby it couldn't. This adult elephant is constrained by his or her assumptions based on earlier experiences. Putting a little rope around one leg activated a belief system that determined behavior. Beliefs cue behavior. A belief is the mind's command to the brain. With the same belief, you'll continue to have the same results. If you change your belief and engage a systematic way of addressing something different, you can get different results. Underline system. That's our specialty. A good idea or a great goal are not enough. Second principle, we don't see things as we are. I'm sorry, scratch that. We don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. The beliefs within us, our own internal map of reality, determine what we perceive, even what we select and register and process, and we construct our storylines from those premises. So we have to bring our beliefs into conscious focus to assess how well they work in present time. This is one of the many coachable moments that we'll have with a client each session. There may be some unconscious biases, inattention blindness, something that is a belief that's driving behavior that they're not even aware of. Remember, 90 to 95% of an operating system is unconscious. So these are the kind of things that we will need to notice and have a collaborative framework to examine together to look at what works and what doesn't. So we don't get what we want, we get what we expect. We always make our beliefs come true. We act in a way to teach people how to respond to us. Third principle, a new story can only occur in the present moment. Social scientists discovered that when you measure someone's intentions, you affect their behavior. For example, you ask people the day before an election, if they intend to vote, it increases the probability of their going to vote by 25%. A study of 40,000 people asked, do you intend to buy a new car? It increased purchase rates in that group as compared to a matched cohort in the next 3 months by 35%. Other behaviors with increased frequency, asking if people intend to eat certain foods, to change their diet, to save for the future. So, state your intentions. Be specific. Write them down. Henry Ford said, you can't build a reputation on what you're going to do. You need a plan. So, remember, you don't need motivation. You just need a plan and to stick to it. Fourth principle, our minds seek closure and infer causality whether or not it's accurate. A number of research findings illustrate that we find something to make sense of what we perceive, even if it's not cause and effect. This is the closure that I talked about when we give a client an idea of what to do or solve a problem. It brings closure for both the coach and the client. Now, it's not going to work, or Google would have worked. They wouldn't need to pay you for getting answers and information and data or get an opinion. They could go to Uncle Harry for that. But it brings closure, whether or not it's accurate, whether or not it's causal. It's a finish without an ending. So I'd suggest reviewing the exercise in the accompanying workbook. In step one, recognize authorship of your story, and specifically look at the definitions of plot and storyline. I'd suggest completing each exercise in step one before you begin to move to exercises in step two. And the same with the subsequent step. The roadmap is sequential. First, you have to recognize that you're the author of the story, and then own it before you can even assess it, because you have to make it yours. So for step two, own your story, I'd suggest highlighting the assumptions and motivations constructing storylines. That's page 1.7 in the workbook. So from an infinite sea of possibilities, our beliefs determine what we see and how we process it. It's our software package. If we add more information to the millions of bits of data that we already process on a daily basis, like adding a new diet or a health club membership, it's not going to have an impact unless you change the software. We'll come back to that. So, as we examine how a storyline is constructed, here's an equation, and this is the outline I think you'll find useful. Beliefs drive behavior. Behavior drives performance. So, if you are a client, if you're not getting the results, the performance that you want, look at the antecedent. What are the behaviors that you can understand and change to generate an optimum performance? With those behaviors, for the ones that don't work, what's the belief that's held them in place and booted them up into an operation for what you do for so long? So, examples of empowering beliefs: I will find a way to exercise 6 days a week. Limiting beliefs: I can't find time to exercise. I don't have enough experience. Now, a fundamental precept of step two: own your story. Whatever you experience, you either create or accept. Now, let's apply that notion by taking the point of reference into consideration and active versus passive storyline construction. These are simply ways to inform your listening and engagement with a client. Point of reference is a pretty basic component of story writing. People who don't own their stories often have a premise of an external point of reference for certain things. Now, here are some examples, and each of these, I believe, for me, it constitutes a coachable moment. They feel as if they have little or no control over things. Life's just happening. Well, there's nothing I can do. They are reacting rather than initiating. They're vulnerable to the responses of others. Their language can even absolve them of responsibility. She makes me so mad. They focus on responding rather than creating. Well, I have to do this. They see themselves as unchanging. Well, that's just the way I am. If they experience a symptom in their bodies, they medicate it away. That's like turning the warning light on the dash of your car off instead of really addressing the issue. Now, contrast that. Those with an internal point of reference, this is what we coach toward. They see their authority as their own. Their premise is active responsibility, and their experience then is effectiveness. They know that, at least since adulthood, they write their own stories. So here are the characteristics. They recognize accountability for their own lives. They're proactive. They plan. They look around the corner. If they experience an unpleasant result, they look at the chain of events that generated that result, then look for alternatives. They decide what to change and initiate that change. And they also realize the menu of choices is created. You can choose, and you can choose how you choose. You don't have to order from the menu that somebody else gives you. So here's a related notion. Recognize active versus passive statements. And this is something that a client will reveal their own position vis-a-vis their authority in a way they construct their sentence. Well, I ran out of time, so I couldn't work out. Now, each of these also, I believe, is a coachable moment. My thoughts ran away from me. This seems to just keep happening. Remember we talked in last seminar, someone constructs an experience, doubt, anxiety, and then sees what they just created as if it's acting on them and making them the victim rather than recognizing they authored it, owning it, so that they can then go to the next step, the third step. Assess the storylines and plots. In other words, to assess what it is you want to change, what you want to keep, what you want to let go. For this exercise, highlight, I want to refer you to two brief exercises about assessment that are both in the workbook that I will, more regularly than any other exercise, will ask a client to do often at the beginning. Needs and ideals. Needs and ideals are at the core of identity, part of the foundation of self. Ideals are the personal model of value, an internal guide to purpose. That's what helps someone know what their true north is. Living up to a personal, attainable ideal generates a sense of worth and esteem. And the only place that I know that shame comes from is having a clear, attainable internal ideal and not living up to it. And a need, as you'll see in the exercise, is an essential requirement. It's a necessity for mind, body, or spirit. So I would suggest doing those too, because when you have a clear idea, and when your client has a clear idea of their top three needs and ideals, their core needs and ideals, then you and that client can together align those or have those inform how you're developing strategies and goals so that all of someone is going in the same direction. Now, one thing to consider is when there are conflicted or contradictory storylines. Now, when you feel with one part of the brain and plan with another, you need a map. Now, here's an example of a conflicted storyline. A woman indicated she wanted to lose weight, but yet wanted to enjoy live food and her summer free of dieting. Now, she's probably going to have to pick one and see if the others can be aligned. So, a paradigm, also called a mindset, it's a model or a theory or frame of reference. It's simply the way we see the world. With the right map, with the right mindset, that's a whole software program. Planning and strategy can make a significant difference. So, it's important to know also that we can be of two or more minds, because the brain has a mind of its own. For example, the prefrontal cortex says, let's set up an exercise program and plan a savings long term. The limbic system says, let's have the cheesecake and order the big screen HDTV. Now, each part of the brain will struggle over the same dollar, hopefully without tearing it. Now, one of the unique qualities we have as human beings is self-awareness. This is what we are helping our clients do, is to have a more empathic resonance with themselves, to become more subjectively and objectively aware of themselves and their experience, and especially regulating states of mind. This causes or facilitates greater self-reflection and self-awareness. And this is huge in developing a model that they're going to take with them for the rest of their lives. So let's go back to you. In your wellness story, is all of you going in the same direction? Do all of the storylines of your wellness story advance the plot and align with your fundamental needs and ideals and have a system to apply it? So also, listen to your self-statements. Whatever people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal values. Whatever you attribute to others, another person, a group, a culture, comes from inside you as a self-statement. We always perceive and create outside to match inside. So pay attention to what you like or dislike, and also don't project your intentions or assumptions onto someone else's behavior, namely your client. Listen for repetitions of the old story. Remember, whatever remains unconscious will likely be attributed to fate. So, for example, if you want to change your body, begin with changing your body image, because you're always reaching your goals, whether they're conscious or not. So if you want to change your body, visualize the specific image you want to achieve, your ideal body image, your true body self. Then create an informed plan to get there. Your body is the projection of your mind software. Now, we'll talk about that more later about the art and science of creating a visualization. But this may be why 95% of people who diet and lose weight will gain it back, often 2 to 3 more pounds, because they change their weight, but they don't change their body image. So listen also to your language in regard to your goals or to your clients. If you say you're going to try to reach a goal, you may be protecting yourself from an anticipated failure. Trying says there's not a full commitment. You know the words of somebody who's not committed. I'll try, I should, I ought to, I know I need to. Those build in a takeaway. This is what we hope to hear from a client and will nudge them to take ownership of their commitment. I will. That's a commitment. And build in accountability by asking, by when? Our smart goals wouldn't have a T on the end. So listen to your body. Your body always speaks to you. You sense it and feel it when you eat healthily, work out, rest well, at the time and later. A huge, delicious dessert is going to taste great at the moment, but the residual feeling and awareness of regret will last longer in time than the immediate pleasure of the great taste. And 80 to 85% of the taste is in the first 3 bites anyhow. Also reflect on studies that show that your body gets accommodated to the same sensation. So you're chasing high like a Coke addict of those first 2 or 3 bites. Listen to your body. Acknowledge and accept its somatic language. Acknowledge what works and what doesn't. Hear your body speak when you eat too much. Eat foods that aren't healthy or drink too much. It's not rocket science. Listen to your body. It's sensitive, accurate, immediate. Pay attention to the message when you work out, when you feel refreshed by taking care of yourself. Your body makes you accountable. A physical symptom contains the message, yet importantly, it is the message. Symptoms give disguised voice to what you avoid knowing. A symptom is a sentinel of a process that needs, begs to be understood, listened to rather than silenced, respected rather than disregarded. A storyline that needs to be heard, a symptom will repeat until translated. When you listen to whispers, no one has to shout. Step 4, decide what to change. Now, we're going to talk about this step after recognizing, owning, and assessing what to change and how to do it. I'd suggest exercises in workbook 2.4, basic inquiries for storyline evaluation, and workbook 2.10, 15 reflections to understand your storyline. Now, a precept for this step, and you heard it in our first seminar, part of the struggle for people to embrace change is because many of the methods to facilitate change are contrary to how the mind and brain work. So, despite being presented with ample evidence of how change will be beneficial, some people don't make changes even when they know it's in their own best interest. Now, your identity is not your behavior or habits. A habit is not a definition. It's simply a choice that gets repeated, a collection of repetitions. If you define yourself by what you do or by your habits, it will be harder to change. So that also is a coachable moment. If someone says, well, you know, I'm a procrastinator, giving it that self-diagnosis closes inquiry because that simply describes a cluster of repetition. So I want to convert that period into a comma and look at the choice architecture of that moment that is alive and here and now that got closed prematurely by saying I'm a procrastinator. People become the stories of who they think they are. Remember from step two, in adulthood you either create your reality or agree to it. And for this, you have to recognize and own your wellness story. Now, let's look at what's involved in deciding to change, to author new experiences. These are things I believe, these are designed only for your ears, not for you to tell your clients any of this, but to help you understand how you can be a better catalyst for your client's story and the co-created new story. This is how the brain opposes change. This is, I believe, crucial to understand because we become specialists at change and focus on choice architecture. Both our minds and brains automatically resist change, as we talked about last seminar. Findings from the cognitive sciences can inform how to change a personal or business or any other story. And remember, when you feel with one side of the brain and think on the other, you need a map. You need a system for change. So each of these principles, I believe, will help you understand better how to facilitate change with your clients. These are 10 precepts of how our brains work, and I think there'll be guidance for you to understand and to facilitate in your own way each of your clients' stories. And some of the first two will be a review of what we talked about last time. One, change generates discomfort. Part of the reason for this resistance to change is any attempt to modify behavior and habits requires an actual rewiring of the brain, which means any step into new territory is going to register as discomfort. Activities that we've repeated that have become habits are hardwired. They're easy because we've done them before. They're automatic. Never mind, they don't work. Neuronal pathways and neural networks, the highways and villages in our brain, have become etched by these repeated habits to create efficient operation to make routine behaviors easy. We don't have to think about, as we talked about last time, how we drive to work each day because it becomes the default mode. But if the default mode is disrupted, you have to think about it. That's annoying. You don't get to listen to the audiobook. When these habits are confronted to change, the basal ganglia in the midbrain, where the automatic pilots are, get disrupted and we feel discomfort. The prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain, has to get busy with more energy and attention to process this thinking. It's work to change. The natural inclination is to resist the stress of change and to preserve the default mode. The brain naturally resists change. That's part of its job description, to repeat what's hardwired. To hardwire behavior saves energy. So our brain opposes what's been adaptive for an evolutionary sense. The promise of change is to develop a new, better default mode, but the brain doesn't know that yet, so our minds have to lead the way. Ray Kurzweil said, "In the singularity is near when humans transcend biology. Civilization advances by extending the number of important operations which we can perform without thinking about them." I was privileged to hear him say that himself in a presentation. It's huge. It's the essence of what we've been talking about. Two, change creates dissonance. Now, couple this brain inclination to keep doing the same thing with the mind's inclination to do what we expect to see. We see what we expect, what our radar has been coded for. In fact, when we don't see what we expect, that's when the error mechanism gets triggered. So it registers as a sense that something's not quite right. So have you had the experience, say, of, you know, you're thinking about some stuff, you go into the kitchen, you know, go into the refrigerator, take a sip of milk, and boom, you suddenly realize it's orange juice. That's the kind of disruption that the brain experiences in its own way when something is not like it's expected to be. Doesn't see it coming, but it certainly registered. Now, the good news, the brain contains neural machinery in this medial frontal cortex to recognize and to correct errors, to optimize behavior. This means these frontal neurons also become active after negative feedback or diminished reward. Now, think about it with clients. Why does somebody decide to do something? The basic reason is that they decide to do something because the way they imagine they're going to feel when they do it. What keeps behavior going? Think about it as a parent and your child. Whatever is responded to is going to sustain or enhance the behavior. Now, it can be negative behavior, it can be good behavior, but if it's responded to, it's going to stay present and probably be enhanced and etched a little bit further. So it's also responding to mistakes. This is great if we remember to discern whether it's a mistake or a neural response and print out to change itself. In other words, if the error detection mechanism is saying this is something different, this is about survival, pay attention to it, or if it's a step into a new and different system and it's the first step of change and we realize it's uncomfortable and register it as discomfort, if you interpret that as, well, my intuition is telling me this is not the right thing, or, you know, my gut is saying this is nothing, that's a misinterpretation. So keep the framework of change and challenge in mind, because that's what you need to frame and to interpret the new experience. Three, the brain's a prediction machine. Do this exercise if you have a pen. I want to give you some numbers. 1, 2, 4, 5, 7, and 8. What's missing? You might guess 3 and 6, multiples of 3. Well, consider this. Nothing's missing. I gave you a complete list of 6 numbers. Everything that's there is there. What's missing, if you thought it was, is inside your head. It's informed by a pattern of expectation. Now, this is huge in writing a new story. Sometimes you have to outsmart your brain. When anything recurs 2 times in a row, the brain predicts a 3rd repetition. A stock goes up 2 quarters in a row, the brain predicts a 3rd. Extrapolation has been called the most common mistake in investing, when we predict the future based on the past. And that's not limited to investing. You'll hear that with your clients and perhaps need to highlight that and examine that together. J. Paul Getty said there are 3 key elements to getting rich. Get up early, work hard, find oil. See, this is the basis of a number of jokes. 2 in a pattern, it sets up a 3rd non sequitur. So this makes it difficult to override emotion and brain patterns to make wise and balanced decisions. This is where your value as a mentor coach and the collaborative framework comes into play. How the brain opposes change? 4, behavioral reinforcements can backfire. Let's say you're the COO of a company determining a policy about employees being on time. Which works better, threats or reinforcements? Well, the answer is neither. They both focus on the negative or avoiding the negative, so they're both likely to backfire. Remember what we do in coaching, to frame something in terms of the challenge, the opportunity, and to look at creating a system to do it. We assume people are going to receive information about change and use it to better themselves. Not so, says the brain. In fact, as you may have seen in the blog, being told what to do or given facts or information can result in an innate opposition or confirmation without thinking about it. The brain's natural homeostasis says avoid change. 5, motivation isn't essential. I've worked with a number of pro athletes and actors in off-season. This is a reiteration of something we touched on last time. They aren't motivated to work out, to go to the gym every day in off-season or throughout the year, but they do it because they know that that's what they need to do in order to do what's next. You do not need motivation to do anything. All you need is a plan and to stick to it. Emotions change brain functioning. When emotions trigger, brain chemicals are released that may prompt toward action away from creativity and assessing knowledge, such as a threat that triggers adrenaline, the stress chemical cortisol, and the function shifts from the forebrain to a different part of the brain entirely. This is why it's so important to regulate states of mind. We'll come back to that. Stimulation, also known as a little bit of stress, enhances memory and learning, but under stress with that stimulation prolonged, we do 2 things, regress to an earlier mode and hyper-focus on the most recent emotional events and lose the big picture. Regulating a state of mind in order to enhance self-reflection is probably the most fundamental way that we can be of help to our clients. We'll come back to that. How the brain opposes change. 8, closure to novelty. Studies show that as even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty as they get older, the major factor is not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as been in a particular business, because also it's come to consolidate their identity. People who stay in one place and one position get most entrenched. So this is our challenge as coaches, to open a closed system, to empathically challenge, to strategically perturbate. Now, these last 2 principles, I believe, are absolutely huge for coaching. 9, and especially wellness coaching. Neurogenesis is the creation of new brain cells. 2 things above all others create neurogenesis: enriched environment and exercise. An enriched environment of, for example, intellectual and emotional stimulation creates more complex brain tissue. That's what we do with our clients: co-create, stimulate thinking, challenge, story bust, nudge. The hippocampus is the part of the brain, in the midbrain, especially connected with creativity and memory. Mice from an enriched environment have a 15% increase in the number of their hippocampal cells. What's your guess about how much exercise increases the number of cells in the hippocampus? 100% increase. Recently, these findings were replicated in non-invasive studies in humans. London taxicab drivers, medical students at the University of Hamburg. And remember, the hippocampus the site of creativity and memory. Another finding, chronic stress impairs neurogenesis, decreases the number of cells in the hippocampus, so both memory and creativity are affected. Now, a final finding, neuroplasticity simply means the brain remodels itself. This has been called the scientific revolution of our time. A region of the brain that originally had one job can be trained to perform another. The brain can reassign job descriptions of neurons. For example, for stroke patients who have a dysfunctional arm as a basis of that stroke, usually the dysfunctional arm is put in a sling so that no accidents occur. In this seminal study, the good arm of those patients was put in the sling, so they're forced to use the bad arm if they want to do anything and contribute to feeding and dressing. After 10 days of this therapy, 24 hours a day, the patients regained significant use of an arm they thought would always hang useless. The brains of these individuals recruited nearby brain neurons to perform the functions of the damaged ones. Now, another example, not only do zoning laws change in the brain, but the amount of cortical real estate that a body part claims and uses can be changed depending on its use. For example, an expert braille reader has a significantly greater area handling the finger reading braille than someone who doesn't. Same for the brain area processing the motor region of the dominant hand of a classical guitarist. Now, the good news, we're not hardwired for life. As you hear, with new experiences, new neuronal pathways, and new neural networks are formed. New highways to new communities in your brain. And some remarkable new research shows consistently repeating new experiences even alters gene expression. So review these two exercises, I would suggest, again, as if you don't have enough highlighted here. The personal feedback assessment, the workbook, 2.5. It's an adaptation of the 360-degree feedback business tool designed to get external feedback. And secondly, reflections to understand your story, your storyline, page 2.10. That's designed for internal feedback. So I want to close with four basic things that neuroscience teaches us about change to apply to a wellness story. One, everyone has prior knowledge that affects how they hear and respond to new information. I called it anatomical realities in their brain. Existing knowledge is the beginning of new knowledge as we think about coaching. It's where new learning starts simply because it can't happen any other way. So we have to begin with where a client is, not with where we are or where facts or science or information is. If information were enough, we'd be out of a job. All they need is Google. Two, the prior information, what they believe, think, is physical, real, and persistent as a neuronal pathway in the brain. Neuronal networks are a physical fact in the brain. They can't simply be removed or easily overwritten by a new or better fact, but they do atrophy with disuse as other networks become active and take their place. Three, if we ignore reality, it will get in the way of new information and change. This is why fixing or giving answers doesn't work. You can't just list the four reasons an idea is wrong and expect it's going to rearrange someone's neural network. We have to begin with their experience, their beliefs, because that's where they are. We have to join them in that process to then go someplace new. This is, I know some of you have heard this story, the most succinct supervision I ever had about this principle. Back in the days when I was practicing psychoanalysis, I offered an interpretation to a woman executive that I thought was going to be really helpful. She paused. I knew something was up. She got up on her right elbow, looked back at me, and said, "No, Kruger, first you've got to be with me before I can go someplace new with you. The most elegant and simple supervision I've ever had. You have to be with a client before they can be before they can go someplace new with you. And four, partly because it's complex and personal, partly because it's subjective reality, which is a little redundant, someone is not always aware of their prior knowledge. That's why the roadmap is there. That's why to recognize, to own, is the first two steps before often you can assess. Now, here's a final story that I want to offer and then open it for questions and discussion. Some penguins who wanted to learn to fly got together and hired a coach. They did an all-day training seminar. They set smart goals, visualized, wrote affirmation. After a few hours of very intense work and systematic work, one penguin flew a short distance. Well, that inspired the whole group. Others were encouraged. Eventually, by the end of the day, they were each flying around the room. When the seminar was over, they left and walked home. Change is a process, not an event. We're in discussion mode now, if you'll manage the background noise. Any questions or clarifications or thoughts about anything that we just talked about? Is the roadmap making sense to you as a systematic way to go about assessing, I would say, your story first, because you're going to be in a better position to help a client assess theirs when you've got yours down and become familiar with maybe different ways to go about it that you can customize in a conversation to do it with your client. Any thoughts or comments on that?
Hi, David. I have a question about the roadmap. Is there a template or something, like a visual? Because I'm reading through, and in Module 3, it's saying the map, you can see where you are and how far you've come. Is there actually a visual that we can use with our clients?
You mean a way of creating a map of that?
Yes.
Absolutely. Ask your client to draw one.
Okay.
If we do it for the client or get them to fit into our system. Now, remember, this roadmap system is to inform you about how to listen and to facilitate and catalyze the exploration and the coaching conversation with the client. Now, for, you know, some people have trained with me to be licensed, specially certified as a wellness coach, and they have that that client workbook that you have to use with clients and to co-brand it and that sort of thing. But that's not the usual, that's not why I'm presenting it here. I'm presenting it so you'll get an idea of how to systematically go about that. And here's an illustration of that and why I think it's important. I'll take that question and make it into a suggestion for our training, our work together, that comes from positive experiences from elite athletes to executives about what their most beneficial application of the training material is. Get a notebook, bring it to each seminar, write down the information that's most important. You'll know it when you hear it. This is an application of a neuroscience principle of putting it in an output channel. Whenever you put new information and learning into an output channel, it completes the circuitry of the brain and makes it a more memorable and accessible story. And to reiterate here, the simplest study that I've seen of this, just recently, University of Waterloo asked two matched group of people to read a passage, the same passage from a book. One read it out loud. One read it silently. The group who read it out loud did 40% on it better on a test that followed. What you write down can become your playbook. Get your client to, if they're visual, they may want to do it visually in a map. If they're, you know, kinesthetic, they may, I mean, think about what the learning and the work and performance style of your client is and ask them how best they can put it into a systematic way to focus. It may be a schedule. It may, you know, whatever, but keep the point of reference, your client story, and the development of that, rather than giving them stuff. I would say, like suggestions or ideas or even a schematic, but develop this in the conversation. Everything, and this is a reiteration, everything that's important, every algorithm that a client has in his or her brain that's important, that will in some way have an impact on their current story, you're going to see, you're going to hear in the work with them. It's going to come alive. You'll never have to go back into the past. This is a way of shaping and developing now and next to get it in an output channel, because this is something a client can do in their own style, whether it's visual or auditory or kinesthetic, not something you provide. So that's my best answer to consider. Now, you may have a different idea from your perspective and from that client, but does that make sense for your question?
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Thank you.
Okay, great. Great question. Thanks. Because you brought up something I think really, really important. And this is why we want to help the client summarize in a sentence at the end of each session what's the most important thing they're taking away. That puts it in an input, in an output channel for them. And then to make a commitment, state it out loud that they're making them themselves. But you, the accountability partner, are witness, and you get them to ultimately say, I will, instead of I'm going to try, I need to, I ought to. So those two ways of closure of the session make the session a complete story and provide a systematic way of creating a map for a specific focused issue. That's going to be your legacy. That's what your client will take with them ultimately, week by week, and then ultimately incorporate it as a way of approaching issues that will work, that they will create for themselves a sense of effectiveness and mastery because they co-create it with you. And that's, I think, an even more important thing that we do with clients than looking at the specific issue and what they're dealing with in the here and now, but we're helping them to download a model that happens while we're talking about other things and happens as we're applying these principles in the work with the client. Any other question? We're out of time. But any other quick question, and I'll do a quick answer, which will be highly unusual. But any other comment or question or clarification? If you think of anything we didn't cover, send me an email or jot it down, and we'll cover it the last seminar in a discussion period, or maybe at the beginning of next seminar, even more immediately. So thank you all very much. I appreciate your energy, your input. I value it a great deal, and I'm looking at wrapping some responses to each of the things you've sent in the seminars, either directly or in the examples or illustrations I give or into the discussion. So I want it to be optimally useful for you. So thanks. Take good care of yourselves. Look forward to picking up right here next time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you.